Welcome to Season 4 of the Fight Science Podcast. I am your host, Jordan Sullivan. In this series, we are speaking to some of the most innovative minds in the world of sports nutrition. We will be discussing everything from research, practice, and performance to give you an inside look into the exciting world of combat sports performance. Today, my guest is Dr. James Moran. Dr. James studied his undergraduate degree and master's degree both at Liverpool John Moores University before beginning his PhD, which focused on the nutritional and energetic demands of rugby players. He has over 5 years' experience working directly with elite athletes from professional rugby players, football players, and boxers in regarding to sports science with a focus on performance nutrition. He currently works with former WBA super middleweight champ Rocky Fielding. In this episode, Dr. James and I discuss his strategies when working with top boxers, the importance of tracking data to ensure a smooth fight week, and we discuss his work assessing glycogen restoration in rugby players to make some predictions about how to best reload fighters. This is a great episode, so let's get to it. All right, green light means we are live, so back for another episode of the Fight Science Podcast, so season 4. We are running our usual performance nutrition chats alongside with our gut health series. But today we're coming back to the realm of performance nutrition. And now we've got another one of our Liverpool John Moores alumni. We've got Dr. James Moran coming in with us. James, thanks for coming in, mate.
Yeah, no problems at all. Brilliant to be invited, mate. So thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Liverpool John Moores is it's a bit of a factory, hey, for producing superstar performance nutritionists. What's the secret over there?
Well, I don't know about superstar, but look, we've got we've got a great group and bunch at Liverpool John Moores, and yeah, I think it's a combination of fantastic university and facilities combined with there's a handful of really applied professors and doctors there that really just want to they want to research the cutting edge of elite performance. And that's all backed up with the fundamental knowledge and the mechanistic knowledge of what we do in the lab as well. So, yeah, I was fortunate to be up there for 9.5 years of the undergrad, master's and PhD. And I've got some really close friends and colleagues up there now that continuing to do research with. So, yeah, I don't think there's a secret sauce per se, but I think it's just a combination of a number of positive factors.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a real good point that you just touched on, because all the researchers that come out of Liverpool John Moores, they all seem to, whenever you talk to them, they're all very good with the theory. Mechanistically, they're very sound, but it's that application as well. It seems like all of the research and all the mechanism all has that applied science, which you don't find with a lot of other research groups. Is that a real big focus for you guys?
Yeah, no, I think any student that comes through that performance nutrition strand, we owe a lot, and we all respect very highly Professor Graham Close and James Morton. And all of that, I suppose that mentality that we have in terms of real fundamental basic, mechanistic knowledge applied with that translational potential of the research we're doing comes from those two blokes and the rest of the team at John Moores. And you know, they are leading the way in our opinion on some of the performance nutrition focus. And when you're a part of a group of professors, doctors, researchers that all have kind of the same vision, it's a special place to be a part of. And we meet up virtually every 4 to 6 weeks. We have all of our performance nutritionists and PhD students that meet up regularly, and we're discussing and we're critiquing each other's work, and we're really trying to get the best out of each other and really kind of put LJMU on the global map. So I think when you get those heads together, you know, the group is more powerful than the single. So it's a special place, mate. It's good.
Yeah, it's like the Illuminati of performance nutrition, eh? Just everyone getting together. So, James, we will get into your PhD, which focused a lot on muscle glycogen in the rugby league and rugby union communities. But before we do that, let's talk about your career working with boxers, because you've worked with some really high-level boxers. You worked with the WBA super middleweight champ, Rocky Fielding. Can we kind of talk about your process? So how do you go about taking these guys through camp? And we'll focus on boxing, because I think we spend a lot of time talking about MMA on this podcast, and I want to get into boxing a bit more because there are slight differences. Talk us through, what's your process when you guys start camp? What are you doing and how do you progress through it?
Yeah, well, look, I just want to start this with, I owe a big thanks to Professor James Morton, who he was the one that kind of got me involved with Rocky Fielding at the beginning. But yeah, you know, the way we start with Rocky really is, as he's entering that camp, I almost turned it up to Rocky like a pre-season period. And the reason I did that, he's a massive Liverpool fan, so I know he understands the language of football. But yeah, and initially we would get him into the university straight away as soon as we know that we're entering that start of the camp. And then we'd go through that pre-season period. And the success of any pre-season period, I guess, is baseline tests. And so we would get him into the lab. We would perform a DEXA scan so that we can understand his body composition, where's he currently sitting. We'd also do some VO2 max tests. We'd do resting metabolic rate. We'd get him under the ventilation hood. And I think the combination of that at the very start of a camp, it really gives you a great insight into, not only visibly can you see, okay, he might be carrying a bit of extra fat mass here and he might not be as fit as we want him to be, but you've now got the data, you've now got the numbers. And I think any athlete in the world to some degree would enjoy looking at the numbers that is individual to them as an athlete. So when you combine the data, the numbers with the support around him, that's a really kind of good base to kickstart a camp on. And then the process moving forward from there was, I would then look at all of that data and look at currently where is he at. And then that would allow me to build his nutritional strategies off the back of that, aligned with the strength and conditioning coach and 100% aligned with the stuff that Jamie Moore and Nigel Travis were doing at the boxing gym with him. And then I think the combination of that over the first 4 to 6 weeks of that pre-season camp, if you like, you can really get some big changes going on straight away. And the one thing I used to do with Rocky, and he won't mind me saying this because he's mentioned this on a webinar that I did, but it was almost leaving no stone unturned. And what I mean by that was that anything nutritional related, from breakfast in the morning, lunch, dinner, snacks, supplements, food prep companies, anything and everything, I basically took control of. So that guy just had to get up in the morning. He just had to follow the plan. And he's come out and said that he, like, that really benefited him because it just allowed him to focus on training and boxing. And I think a lot of weight making athletes, you know, part of the stress and the anxiety and concern sometimes is the nutrition. And I didn't want Rocky to worry about that. So I just took control of that 100%. And like I said, it almost allowed that guy to just be robotic in nature in a way where it was just wake up, eat according to the plan, focus on strength, focus on sparring, focus on boxing and sleep, and then repeat.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you go about planning his nutrition? I guess first, how long did you give you guys self for? Was it a standard 8-week camp? And then how did you go about periodizing his nutrition for all these training sessions he was doing?
Yeah, so I mean, in answer to the standard camp length, this was, I'm in process of writing a case study now with all of this data, but I'm just looking at it here on screen. So we had the 6 camps that I've worked with Rocky. We had camp duration variability from 15 weeks down to 6 weeks. So, and the 15-week camp wasn't really an error on our part. It was just, unfortunately, the fight night was getting delayed and delayed. So we entered the camp with like a 10-week camp and then it just got delayed. So you then have to make the decision, are we staying in camp? And is it just going to be a horribly long one, or are we going to come out and then come back in? And for that one, we decided to stay in because his mentality at the time was he just wanted to stay in that kind of frame of mind of, I'm in camp, I'm staying focused. And then the 6-week camp was actually the camp where we went over to Germany and he won his world title. And 6 weeks out from that, Rocky got the phone call from his management team basically saying, right, you've got the opportunity to fly to Germany to fight Zoiga in his backyard. By the way, it's in 6 weeks' time. Are you taking a fight? Now, I don't think there's many fighters that would turn down the opportunity to fight for a world title if it was 2 weeks or 20 weeks. So ideally, you know, 6 weeks is not a good length for a camp, but he was in good shape and he was never, ever going to turn that fight down. And so I had to look at that as a practitioner and go, well, I'm not going to let him do that on his own, because for me, that would be even more irresponsible. So it's going to be tight. We're going to have to really focus and really tighten up the screws on everything nutritional and everything and anything that could manipulate his weight. And we did. And we had a 6 weeks kind of intense focus. Yeah. You know, 6 weeks that was unbelievable, because it ended in a phenomenal win in Germany in someone's backyard. So yeah, camp duration never really stays the same.
How does your priorities change? How does it change when, say, you've got that, say, 12 to 15 weeks or 8 to 15, let's say, a more longer camp? Say, when you get a six-week camp, how does your priorities change as the performance nutritionist on the team?
Well, I think they have to change, and you have to adapt to the situation, right? And I remember one of the first things I did was actually speak to the S&C coach and speak to Jamie. And I'll never forget Jamie telling me, and it was such a valuable lesson, because this is an ex-boxer who's a very, very highly respected trainer. And he said to me that although nutrition is important, and it is, he said, we've got to remember that he's a fighter. And so what we need to do is we need to support everything to allow Rocky to spar at the best of his ability, because we've only got a short duration now. So the conversations between me and Rocky weren't really so much focused on, we're going to try and pull your weight down. Like, that was always a goal in the background and it was always going to happen. But every single conversation I was saying to him, it was all about, we need you to fuel so that you can go and do a good strength session. We need you to recover well so that you can then go and do a good spar with Jamie. And it was all focused about performance, performance, performance. The knock-on effect of him following a very tight nutrition strategy, but with the focus on, I want to train the house down for 6 weeks and I want to recover as quick as I can so that I can go in and spar to the best of my ability. The knock-on effect of that was always that his weight was going to come down. But it wasn't like the focus of my conversation with him, because if it was, I think it would have created more stress and anxiety for him, because he would have thinking, Christ, I've only got 6 weeks to get this weight off. And like I said earlier, I didn't want him to panic about weight. Like, it was always going to come off, because he was doing triple training days and he was eating RMR plus 500 calories, maybe. So, you know, the seesaw was definitely leaning to the side that he was always going to lose the weight, but I didn't want it to be the topic of conversation every time. And I'm just looking here, like, on that 6 week camp, so he actually lost 10.6 kilos in total in 6 weeks, which was a 1.76 kilo loss per week. Now, that sounds like ridiculously high, which it is, but considering he lost 3.6 kilos in the final 7 days following, you know, well-cited acute weight loss strategies from the likes of Reed Reels PhD with Gary Slater and Louise Burke, when you factored in that 3.6 kilo of acute weight loss in the final 7 days, his actual relative weight loss per week, including the acute weight loss, was only now 1.1 kilo. So that's quite a doable amount for a weight-making athlete when you combine a nutritional strategy that is well under what he's expending. And the knock-on effect was that he managed to lose that weight over that six-week period.
What percentage of his body weight was that, James? What did he lose in the 5 weeks of the camp, percentage body weight wise? And then what was that as a percent in that final 7 days?
Yeah. I mean, one thing I did do with Rocky for, certainly for the Zoyga fight and then also the Canelo fight where we went over to New York to defend it. One thing I was really focused on, I guess, was tracking and capturing his exact weight about 35 days out. So it was almost the moment we knew about Zoyga, and I knew how critical that weight loss was going to be. I said to Rocky, look, I really think that we should just capture your body weight every single day. I don't want you to worry about it, but I just want it to be a process now that every single day we step on the scales in the morning after that morning urine, and then just ping it over to me and that's it. I don't want you to worry about it. Just let me capture it. And we did that for the 35 days. And so to answer your question, at 34 days out prior to the weigh-in for the Zoiga fight, he was 13.6% body weight change. And this is what I presented on one of my webinars recently, that the final 7-day period, Rocky was at 4.7% above his weigh-in. Now, that's the final 7 days. Now, I know, and you know better than me, that in the MMA culture, unfortunately, some of these guys lose up to like 10% in the final 24, 48 hours. And so, you know, I knew that in that final 7 days, considering Rocky was 3.6 kilos above his weigh-in weight, which represented a 4.7% body weight change, I knew that that was more than doable on someone of his stature at 6'2". And then when we went to New York to fight Canelo, we just tried to mirror that exactly. And so in that camp, I set him some target weights. They weren't daily weights. They were just weekly weights. And then we managed to almost hit that exactly on.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And it's a good point. And like I said earlier, that's why I like talking to boxing nutritionists when it comes in, because like that's a great number. Like 4.7% is great. You can do it very safely using like Reed's water loading strategies, a low fiber strategy. You can move it and you can wake up and walk on the scales, where like you alluded to, MMA guys are, you know, doing that plus 5%, plus or minus 5% in the final 24 hours. For that, when you got the call, James, and you were 13.6% out, you obviously went RMR plus 500. Is that more aggressive than what you regularly do when you've got the longer period of time? Or did you know with the increased training load to kind of make up for it that you would be able to fall and hit your regular targets?
Yeah, so, I mean, for the Zoiga fight there, we actually went a little bit lower. So I'm just going to... We went about RMR, give or take 250, 300 kcals above. But one thing we focused on, which again is all over the literature, was increasing that protein intake. So trying where possible to look after his lean mass and just trying to make sure that the majority of his calories were coming from protein to really try and stimulate the fat oxidation as he was expending the energy. Unfortunately, similar to Professor James Morton's case study that he'd done a few years ago, and I know Stu Phillips talked about this as well, unfortunately we did lose lean mass in that camp simply because he was just in a catabolic state. And you know, that was definitely a conversation that I had with Rocky to say, look, at the moment, this is your lean mass or fat-free mass on the DEXA. We are going to have to lose some of that. We are going to have to drop some of that down. But let's try and put you in a body composition profile that is actually better than your last camp. And to do that, we need to get a kilo more fat off. If we get a kilo more fat off, we can keep a kilo more fat-free mass. So that, you know, they were the motivation, kind of dangling the carrot in front of Rocky to say, look, like this is the focus. It's the biggest fight of your career. Like, let's absolutely nail it. Let's not leave any stone unturned. And I think one thing that massively helped us, and this is where, you know, performance nutrition was definitely the focus, but actually zooming out sometimes and looking at where you are, your environments. And the reason I'm saying this story is because when we were in East Germany, when we were in Germany for the Zoiga fight, The weather over there, it was July in Germany, and it was about 30 degrees on the day before weighing and the day of weighing. And I'm looking at the numbers again here. Rocky woke up 2.3 kilos above the weighing weight on the day of weighing, which represented a 3% body change. So we were looking at the weather, and I remember sitting down with Elliot, who was the S&C coach, and just saying to him, like, we don't have to do anything aggressive here because it's 30 degrees. Like, we're at breakfast and we're sweating already and we're not trying to make the weight. So if anything, we get up, we go for a little jog with Rocky around the block, and that was it. Rocky is a pretty quick sweater. He perspirates after about 8 minutes on the treadmill normally. And so we knew that if we went out early in the morning and we just started getting that metabolism firing and opening up the pores, he was going to make that weight so easy. And Rocky didn't ever have to sit in a sauna.
He didn't have to forcibly sweat, so to speak. He just sweated and perspirated as part of going for a run. And then he did some skipping outside, and bingo, we'd made the weight at 1 o'clock, and the weigh-in wasn't until four. So, I guess the reason I've said that is because sometimes you capitalize on your environment that you're in as well.
Yeah, and I think a good point that I want to highlight just from looking at these numbers that I've written down. So if you came into the fight week at 3.6 kilos, it was about 2.2 on the weigh-in day or something, you had to do, or about 1.7% off or so. So you lost 1.7% during the days leading up to that. So about 1.4 kilos. And I'm assuming if you use Reed's protocol, you would have used a bit of a water load. Did you keep carbohydrates in the diet, and did you just opt to go low fiber?
Yeah, I mean, interestingly enough, I've never done a water load with Rocky, ever. So the strategies that we had used in Germany and that worked very well were the reduction of fiber, the reduction of sodium, and then just looking at utilizing low food weights. And so Rocky, the day before weighing, I remember him, we got up in the morning and we went out for a walk. His family were over in Germany as well, so we all met up together. And we went and had a breakfast with a black coffee, two egg omelet, mid-morning snack of like protein bar or protein shake. And then I remember at lunch he had a salmon fillet just with some steamed rice, not boiled in salt water or anything. And then evening dinner, I think again, we just opted for some eggs on toast. And that was the day before. So it was all quite light in terms of weight of food. It wasn't really dense and heavy, but there was definitely a conscious effort of we're going to reduce the carbs down. And on that day, he probably only had about 50, 60 grams of carbohydrates total. So you're beginning to near kind of the ketogenic side of stuff. But I think I just knew that he was always going to make it because I knew where his weight was. And I knew that if we had a 4 o'clock weigh-in the next day, Christ, if you're up at 8 o'clock in the morning, like you've got a decent amount of time to make the weight. So providing Rocky was comfortable to eat, and he was gobsmacked that we were allowing him to have some stuff. Then the day of weighing, it was just a coffee. And then I just had a bag of Jelly Babies on me. And it was almost like, feeding him when he did something well. So like at the end of the run, it was like, well done, mate, you can have two Jelly Babies. But, and again, it was just a little bit of sugar to get into his mouth. And he wasn't hungry at all, really, because he'd eaten the day before. Yes, we'd gone low calories and we'd dropped the carbs down, but he had food in him. He had food in his stomach. And so in those last 48, 72 hours, like we did, we reduced glycogen, we reduced the fiber, we reduced the weight of food. But the big thing for him, psychologically, he was just in an unbelievable place. Like his family were in Germany. He knew he was going to make the weight. He was comfortable. The weather was amazing. He was going to fight for a world title. He was confident. And it all just kind of gelled unbelievably well to result in that fourth round stoppage.
Hey guys, I just wanted to jump in here and it'll be quick. I know, I'm not a fan of ads either, but this isn't an ad. Well, it is, but I literally get nothing out of doing this. I just want to give a shout out to some of the businesses that have helped and continue to help me along my journey. Before You Speak is quite possibly one of the fastest growing coffee brands coming out of Australia. To be quite honest, I'm a bit of a coffee snob, and these guys have absolutely ruined coffee for me. I literally cannot drink anything else. As a matter of fact, one of my UFC fighters loves it so much that when we were cutting weight for one of his fights, he made me factor in the weight of a Before You Speak coffee so he could have it the morning before he weighed in. That's a true story, and I have a video of it on my Instagram. This stuff is legit, and if you want to try it, they have been kind enough to do a discount code for my listeners. Just head to their website and enter TFD10 to receive a 10% discount. All right, back to the podcast.
Yeah, and that's such a good point that you bring up too, because obviously, like, and that's a credit to you that you could get him down there and it could be that easy and he could be eating, you know, salmon and eggs and even getting those carbs, 56, and eating the Jelly Babies. That's something we don't talk about a lot, is that the mental side of it. It's huge for these guys, for them to be able to have three meals a day with snacks and then have, you know, some candy in between here. It's massive mental benefit for them as well. I think this is a good little segue and we can start talking about the work that you and Dr. Warren Bradley did in the muscle glycogen replenishment, because
although we did, you guys did reduce the glycogen, it's not like you were aggressively cutting out carbohydrates for, you know, 5+ days, trying to suck all the carbs and water out. And everyone in the field knows what detrimental effect that can potentially have. Can you start talking about, well, let's go through your studies about muscle glycogen, and we can bring it back and talk about how this would be important for fighters to not get so aggressive in doing this.
Yeah, so first things first on this, this was 100% Dr. Warren Bradley's PhD study. So, you know, I don't want to take credit for that study per se, because it was all part of his PhD. But look, me and Warren, we ran that study at Widnes Vikings at the time where I was working as a performance nutritionist. And again, you know, owing respect and thanks to the John Moores kind of team that we have, we had about 25 members of staff and students at the time that were all part of that study to allow it to happen. But essentially what we did, we got the buy-in of the academy head coach, we got the buy-in of the CEO of the club, we explained what the study was about and the benefits that it would give to the club and the players, and they were all over it. So we got the big green light. And then we split the players in half, and essentially we gave half of the players a 6 g/kg carbohydrate body mass diet for 36 hours leading into the game. And then the other half of the team, we gave 3 g/kg of carbohydrate for body weight. So what we'd done there is we'd split the group into what we would term a low carbohydrate feeding strategy and then a higher. It most certainly wasn't the highest in the literature at 8 to 10 g, but it was probably more representative of what rugby players do consume. Now, as well with that, considering that some rugby players are 100 kilos, you're still looking at 600 grams of carbs, which is still a decent amount to put in the tank. So we'd split the group, they consume their diets, and then we then got them into the changing room in a stadium, and we performed a number of tests. We did counter movement jumps, some performance output tests. And then the two big things that we collected were blood samples and then muscle biopsies. And the muscle biopsies, you know, this was probably the key thing from the study. We were putting muscle biopsy needles into professional academy rugby players live at a competitive fixture before they were going to go out and play an 80-minute game. And, you know, this is where I think rugby league players or rugby players in general are unique characters, because you know, we didn't have anyone complain. They ripped into the process. We even had a couple of players faint because the sight of a 9-inch needle going into their quadricep. Probably shouldn't say that on this because of ethics, but hey ho, it's published now. So we collected the muscle out of the leg before the game. And then we then had a team of people where we were strapping up the biopsies. We were putting the butterfly stitches on them. And then the players went out and played this 80-minute game. And what was brilliant is that even some of the players that had fainted were persistent on playing this game, which once we got medical clearance, they were there out on the pitch as well. And then, yeah, we did a 2 40-minute halves representative of a rugby league fixture. All of the GPS data was coming back and saying that the match play demands were on par with senior grade rugby league. So in terms of distance covered, high acceleration sprints, the amount of collisions that were performed, etc. So we knew that it was representative of a senior game as well, albeit that they were probably lighter players. The game represented a physical rugby game, high impact collisions all over the place, muscle damage going on. And then the beauty of this study was that they finished the game, the players jogged in straight into the changing room. And then there they were back on their muscle biopsy stations. We had 4 stations set up in the change rooms. And we then managed to do muscle biopsies post-game within a 30-minute window on all of those players again. And it was fascinating. It was unbelievable to see the whole thing in operation, from the CEO that was interested in the study, from the head coach, from the academy coach, to the players, to all of the staff and research group at John Moores. It was just an unbelievable collective effort. And once we analysed the biopsy data, it then gave us some really interesting data. Now, first thing to note was that there were some players in the 3 g/kg that actually had muscle glycogen levels
on par with the 6 gram per kilo group, which probably said to us that unfortunately they may have got a bit hungry and that they decided to, you know what, I need to eat a little bit more because I'm starving and I'm not used to eating 3 gram per kilo. But there's a lesson there, and I'll draw on that in a minute. But the other thing was that the 6 gram per kilo group, they managed to store a lot more muscle within the glycogen as expected compared to the 3 gram group. But the big take home of this was that some of the players that consumed as low as 3 gram per kilo, by the end of the game, they had glycogen levels underneath 100, which would signify that they were pretty much nearing complete depletion of glycogen within the muscle fiber. Now, granted, you've got the type 1 and type 2 muscle fibers that you're obviously taking the biopsies from, but at least in the biopsy samples that we had, they were nearing fatigue. And so that said to us that you would probably never want your team consuming as low as 3 gram, because if it's a really demanding game, you're having to play a really defensive set or a backlog of defensive sets, then the likelihood is that you're going to get players that are going to hit fatigue. And the big thing with that is if you've got congested fixture windows, the likelihood of that player being ready to roll again in 2 days' time for the second game is minimal, because we know that to replenish and resynthesize a muscle fully can take up to 72 hours anyway. So the big lesson there was that a 6 gram per kilo diet would be the recommended intake for professional rugby league players. Now, you could argue that you might actually want to consume a little bit more than that, but we kind of suggested that according to that study, 6 grams should be the target, minimum target for professional rugby players. Really nice study. And yeah, like I said, just unbelievable to be part of, to do the first biopsy study of its kind worldwide in rugby players.
How'd you go with compliance? That's amazing. I'm kind of a bit starstruck that you guys were able to set up all of the stations and the guys came straight in and you got 100% compliance within the participants.
Yeah. So we had, we may have had one player where we didn't get a post-game biopsy. And I think on my memory, it was the same player that had passed out before the start of the game. And he just wasn't too keen on having it done. And of course, we're never going to force a player to do it. But I think the one of the successes here, and it's not blowing my own trumpet at all, but it was, I'd been at the club a year and I'd developed and built relationships with players. And, helping them from a performance nutrition side of things. And one thing that I was able to do was to build that relationship with your players, build the trust. And I think when I presented the study to the squad and told them the benefits that this could have versus other players and clubs in their league, then it was almost a no-brainer for them. It was a no-brainer for them to be part of this, because they knew that, okay, if we've got this information before anyone else, if there's other players at other clubs that are consuming 3 or 4 grams, we know that they're under fueling. And so that if we could put a whole squad of 13 players out on the field that had fueled up 6 gram per kilo minimum, you could almost look at your opposite team and say, I know that I'm more fueled than you. And I know that the back end of the game, when you're hanging out at the back doors, I'm definitely going to have more energy than you. And that's where you do see it. You see games open up in the last 15 minutes because players are just fatigued. So I think the big compliance there, mate, was having the buy-in of the club, buy-in of the players and buy-in of the head coach. And it was never mandated, but it just become part of the process for that team.
Yeah, that's absolutely phenomenal. James, leading up to that, so the weeks coming in, they were following the 6 grams per kilogram. How long was that for before they came into the testing, they did the initial biopsy? Were they following that diet for, say, 5 days, 7 days, or 2 days, or how long was it?
Yeah, no, they weren't, because the game was played at the weekend. And so leading into that, for the start of that 36-hour window before the game, so that would have been, what, Thursday, midday-ish. We just said to the players before that, obviously, the key focus here is that you are a professional player at a club and you are required to do your training. And so we didn't want to impact the training that the coach wanted to do with the players on the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And so we just said to them, like, consume habitually what you would normally consume.
we didn't want them to go low carb and then come into their study, because again, that wouldn't be representative of what professional rugby players do. And the big thing that we spoke about at the start for us as a group at John Moores is that we want to be performing studies in elite athletes that are representative of what these guys do day in, day out. We don't really want to, I never wanted to say to my players, consume low carb for 5 days and then let me super compensate it at 6 grams per kilo, because that wouldn't be what they do in a normal week. And it wouldn't be representative of the translational potential that we wanted for the study.
So they were eating this high carb or the 6 grams per kilogram for 36 hours, which in my area, which is in, you know, MMA, and that's a post weigh-in window. So it's very interesting. So it's like, to me, I hear that and I think, well, 6 grams per kilogram theoretically could make it work. Do you think that is theoretically possible, say, if you were going to do this with Rocky or going through, or how much did you feed Rocky when he was in this post weigh-in period? Because again, with Rocky, you weren't aggressively depleting. He was still eating carbohydrates up there. Do you have the numbers to compare for what he ate after he weighed in?
So for Rocky, we definitely went lower carb leading into the final period. And I've actually got, so on, if we look at what I termed weigh-in minus two, so on the Wednesday before the weigh-in, we had 136 grams of carbohydrates going in, which represented a 1.7 gram per kilo of body mass for Rocky. And then on the Thursday, the day before the weigh-in, we had 85 grams of carbs, which represented a 1 gram per kilo. And that was the day before. So, you know, he was still consuming a decent amount of carbohydrates. And then once Rocky had weighed in, as expected, we did aggressively reload it. And post weigh-in on the Friday, we had 374 grams of carbs going in, which represented a 4.6 gram per kilo. So that wasn't as high as I'd probably hoped. But again, I didn't want to force feed like food into Rocky. Again, it was all about, I want the bloke to enjoy eating food again, because you know, there were certain things that he hadn't had for weeks. And I remember in Germany, you know, we walked past this ice cream parlor. As I said, it was 30 degrees. And I said to Rocky, I went here, I said, you fancy one of them chocolate sundaes? And the joy and the lighting up of his eyes was unbelievable. But I was looking at that going, okay, it's a very, very carbohydrate dense dessert, which has got sugar in it, which is only going to saturate his muscles with glycogen, ready for the fight tomorrow. And so that was something that we put in there. And then on fight day itself, we managed to hit 356 grams of carbs, which represented a 4.4 gram per kilo. So we definitely had an aggressive reload compared to weigh-in minus two and weigh-in minus 1 days. Was it as high as I wanted him to go? I don't know is the honest answer. But one thing I do know is that it put him back in the ring in Germany against Zoiger, and then in New York against Canelo, he went back in the ring at 82 kilo. So you're looking at a 76.2 kilo weigh-in, and then you've got that, 6 kilo of weight going back in. And of course, that's not really fat mass. It's essentially water going back into the body. It's water binding with the glycogen within the muscle. And of course, it's food weight. The guy's now just eaten some pretty big meals, and he's got a stomach that's full of food, and he's got muscles that are full of glycogen.
Yeah. James, just based on your research in the rugby study, how pragmatic do you think it would be, say, for Rocky or other fighters in that time? Like you said, the recommendations, if you're going really aggressive, is 8 to 10 grams per kilogram. Do you think it's pragmatic for them to get that in that time period?
It's a great question, mate. And I think this is where it comes down to your individual athlete, isn't it? It's to look at, of course, relative to body weight, 8 grams per kilo for a heavyweight like AJ or Ruiz. You know, that's a lot of carbohydrates. But 8 grams per kilo for a 50 kilo boxer, like, it's probably, you know, you may be able to get that in with food and fluid and gels, etc. But I don't know. I think this is where, you know, the world of boxing and weight making and fight game probably needs a biopsy study done.
it probably needs someone to go out there and do it with some professional athletes, because by the simple virtue of a boxing fight, 12 rounds being 30 to 40 minutes, depending on, you know, ref stoppages or whatnot, like you're basically doing one half of rugby. Now, trying to compare the sports is ludicrous because the demands are so different. But, you know, if you look at an 80-minute rugby game where they're covering best part of 10 to 13K, where you've got a 100-kilo bloke running into 300-kilo blokes, and they're trying to break through tackles, you've got exercise-induced muscle damage, you've got impact-induced muscle damage. Trying to compare that to boxing is completely different. But boxing, of course, has its high intense 3-minute bouts with a minute's recovery. Like, it's an insanely demanding sport in its own right. Do you know what? I think, is it time that we try and get some biopsies or at least some bloods in, you know, out of our boxers' start of a competitive fight and at the back end of a fight as well? It'd be great to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to put you on the spot again, James, just because I want to hear your opinion on it. So with Rocky, when he came down and he did this, you said for that last 1.4 kilos, he was just moving around lightly and he was just doing a bit of jogging and whatnot. So obviously he's going to be, if he has spare glycogen there, he's going to be burning it. You're going to be translocating those GLUT4 receptors to some extent. I know in the world that I come from, that isn't so much common practice in the way that we're getting off that last, say, anywhere between 2 to 5+% body weight is sitting in a sauna or sitting in a bath and you're sweating. How do you think that would affect that glycogen resynthesis process? Say if you're trying, even if we say, hey, we want to get 4 to 6 grams per kilogram, but the way that we've moved that weight in the last 24+ hours was by passive dehydration, where we're sitting in a sauna or sitting in a bath and we might not be translocating those GLUT4 receptors. Do you think that's going to play a role in how efficiently these guys are glycogen replenishing?
Yeah, well, what a question. And there's got to be something there, hasn't there? There has to be, because, I mean, if we step away from the direct question a little bit, I've been there where we've tried early on with Rocky, where we have sat in a sauna to try and get a kilo off. And I found it horrendous. I hated it. I had a headache after. It was disgusting. I did not enjoy it at all. And neither did Rocky. And I look at that and I think, why, if you're not enjoying that process, why do it? Because psychologically, you're probably going to go to bed a little bit annoyed with yourself because you're in a mood, you're not happy. And then it's the psychological impact the next day where you may not have had a great sleep. Like your feelings and thoughts towards trying to make the weight or consume a little bit of food now you've made the weight. I don't know. I just think that psychological aspect of making a fighter moody and not enjoyable, not having fun. I think when we can relate food to emotions so strongly, I would say that alone the next day may have an impact on someone's ability to just want to consume food because they're just in a mood. They just didn't have a good sleep. And quite often we know, don't we, that, you know, if we go out and have a few drinks and we're a little bit hungover or we haven't slept well ourselves, like, our choices the next day are probably not going to be the best when we're tired and fatigued. So I think there's definitely something there. And then I think you're right, mate. I think that if the way that we had done the weight with Rocky, I'm not saying it's the golden scenario, but certainly, you know, actively utilizing glycogen within the muscle and burning it via exercise contractions, I think that would help the fact the next day that you're now trying to replenish that glycogen back into that muscle, rather than you're basically sweating off, you're sitting in a sauna to lose water. What we were doing is not necessarily losing water on its own by sweating and going for a run in 30 degrees, but we were also burning glycogen. And so we were depleting the glycogen down that last few, 10-15%, you know, that's an arbitrary number, I'm making it up, but by bringing it down that tiny little bit lower again from a 30 minute run, you know, we know that then as soon as you start putting glycogen back in, the muscle is going to start resaturating quicker. I mean, we know that from some of the football studies, that if you look at the first 4-hour window after a game is when the muscle is hypersensitive to whatever substrate you're going to start feeding it. And that's why if you look at there's a UEFA consensus statement coming out this year. It's in for a review at the moment. But the guidelines on that are clearly that you've got that first 4-hour window to try and really maximize the amount of glycogen resynthesis that you can do. And if you miss that first 4-hour window, then the likelihood is that you're going to go into the next training session or game with an element of fatigue. So, yeah, to answer your question with a binary yes or no, I think it would affect it.
Yeah, and it's phenomenal, and you're absolutely spot on. I think it's about time we start doing some of these biopsy studies. And I think this is why I enjoy talking to guys who've gone through that Liverpool John Moores program, because you said it perfectly just before with your how you guys set up the study with the rugby players, is that you only did it for the 36 hours because that's what's practical. And it's like, you know, if you're going to do this with the athletes, we need to sit down. We can pull information, say, from your study, and I can pull it and go, okay, that's really good. But what's practical for my athletes? And, you know, for combat athletes, that most of them are these days are sitting in a sauna and sitting in a bath and doing it that way. And it's like, well, we don't know. We don't know if this is, you know, all the theory in the world can go well. I feel like we're almost missing that practical approach. So it's a very interesting question. But, you know, regardless, nonetheless, I really enjoy that, because that number 4.6, 4.4, personally, in my practice, that's what I find with my guys, that I can get them to physically hit. Despite aiming for something a lot higher, I just feel they can't. And like you said, alluded to, it takes the enjoyment out of food. There's only so many, like, you know, Sundays I can shove in front of these guys' faces before they tell me to get out of it. But James, anyway, that was a great chat. I'm being very mindful of the time. But before we get going, guys listening in, they're obviously going to want to reach out to you and they're going to want to follow your work. What's the best way for them to do that? Are you on socials, emails? What's the best way to get in contact with you?
Yeah, for sure. So I currently work at the FA, the English Football Association. So people can, I'll send you my email address and you can put that in the show notes or whatever it is. And then, yeah, I'm active on Twitter, James_Moorhen. And then also on Instagram as well. So Moorhen Performance on the Instagram. And then, yeah, more than happy to, I really enjoy these conversations and discussions and sharing work. So if people want to reach out and share experiences, then let's do it. And I think it's a matter of time before these studies do happen. I was just, as you were talking there, reflecting on if I asked Rocky to do something like that, would he? And I genuinely believe that if we did a biopsy in training and then he went into sparring and he knew what it felt like, I genuinely believe that man would probably let me do a biopsy study on him.
I was just about to finish that with you. I was almost going to prompt you and say, hey, maybe you should look at doing this with Rocky.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we had with the rugby players was the unknown. They were like, you know, is it going to hurt? Like, what's the effect? And of course, the best way I describe it, I've had 12 of them, and the best way I describe it is almost like being shot by a paintball gun. It's that initial thud and sting, and then yeah, it's almost like a dead leg. But once you get over that, it's focus on the game and play the game and forget about it. So I've gone off on a tangent again, but
no, absolutely, I think there's some really good studies to be had there. But anyway, James, I won't hold you up any longer. Thanks for coming on, mate, and no doubt I'll chat to you soon.
Yeah, no worries, all the best.
And there it is, another episode of the Fight Science Podcast. Dr. James embodies what it means to be a true professional in the nutrition field. By meticulously programming and tracking data on his clients, he is able to ensure that they go into their fight in the best shape possible. Be sure to follow him on his socials to keep up to date with his work. This podcast will be available through the podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, and you'll also be able to download it from my website, www.thefightdietitian.com/podcast. If you enjoy listening to the podcast, then be sure to head to the podcast app to give us a rating and leave us a review. Thanks for listening in, and I'll see you guys for the next episode of the Fight Science Podcast.